what Vice President Cheney meant that day. He went on Meet the Press and said, we're going to have to work kind of on the dark side. He basically was arguing the threat to America posed by al-Qaeda was so existential and terrifying that we had to do anything and everything, literally leave all our values behind and work in the shadows.
You can see we're changing things around a little bit today. We don't have the high podium. Jane and I decided it might be fun to do this in the form of a conversation and maybe involve more people in the group here in asking questions. So starting at about half past the hour, Cristina Lopez-Gattardi will be in the back. And if you would like to jump into the conversation, don't feel that you're interrupting things by standing up and going back. In fact, we encourage you to do so. We think we get really good questions from the audience. In fact, almost every speaker who is here compliments the quality of the questions we get compared to what they get at other places like Harvard and Stanford and so on. It's a pleasure to welcome today Jane Mayer, who is another of the outstanding New Yorker staff writers who have spoken at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. For 12 years after graduating from Yale University, Jane Mayer worked at the Wall Street Journal, and she joined the staff of the New Yorker 13 years ago in 1995. Jane Mayer is the author of, or co-author of two earlier books. One, Strange Justice, was written by Jill Abramson, and it was a finalist for the National Book Award about 10 years ago. And then her book, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, was about the Iran-Contra affair that she co-wrote with Doyle McManus. Her new book, which has been right at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for many months, is The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. So please welcome Jane Mayer.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad to be here today. There probably aren't too many people who see similarities between me and John McCain, but we both like the town hall format better. So anyway.
Jane, in your book, the title of your book, you talk about the American ideals, and later in the book you use the term the soul of America. How would you describe the American ideals or the American soul that was so contested in what the lawyers at the Justice Department were doing?
Well, I used that word partly because I could tell when I was interviewing people that they felt so strongly about this subject of whether America should actually embrace something like torture or coercion, whatever you want to call it. There was a sense that this was a really deep issue for people that went beyond the usual blue state, red state politics. There was something very deep going on. And I think it goes way back in the American psyche, basically to the founding of the country on the notion that all people have inalienable rights and are endowed by their creator with those rights. And in our Bill of Rights, and we have obviously strictures against forcing people to testify against themselves and also against cruel and unusual punishment. And then these ideals were very much not just part in the minds of the founders and the Enlightenment values of the country, but became so woven into the ethos of the country really from the start, from the time that George Washington was fighting the revolution. He made a great point of when we took prisoners of war in the revolution, he said, we are not going to treat them the way the British do, where they were brutalizing. It was considered scandalous in its day. They were brutalizing the American soldiers because they considered them illegal enemy combatants, a phrase that is what we were calling al-Qaeda. And the point was in Washington's writings about this, both that we were a new country with Enlightenment values trying to show a new way in the world and not to be primitive and not to be sort of something from the Dark Ages, so to speak, but also he thought that it was smart policy It was self-serving. If we treated prisoners of war well, we would have more people coming over to our side. We would show that we were a country that might actually bring defectors to us, and it worked. Some of the Hessians came over and others, and the people that we held as prisoners were impressed, and some joined our side. So it was beginning with Washington and then running on through Lincoln, where you know the Lieber Codes were written. It was the first real code on how to treat prisoners of war. Lieber was a professor at Columbia, but he sort of famously said that that military necessity does not permit of cruelty. The point being that when you take military prisoners, they're not just criminals. There's something honorable even about the other side, and you have to treat them in some way that's not just cruel. And in the Civil War, there was obviously terrible cruelty in Andersonville and other places, but people were prosecuted for that, which was a first in many ways. And so America really has led in blazing the high road in the treatment of prisoners of war and on through its participation in the Geneva Conventions and the Nuremberg Trials. And people may not realize this, but the originals of the Geneva Conventions are housed in the State Department. So America has a very special role as its the guarantor. And so these values are I think very, very much part of our military and very much part of our just general population.
Jane, in your title, you use the term the dark side, and we all remember Vice President Cheney's appearance on Meet the Press shortly after 9/11, where he said, we'll have to work sort of on the dark side. But there are really two dark sides that you talk about in your book. One is the so-called black sites, where the CIA rendered people to be to have an enhanced interrogation applied to them. And the other is really within the Justice Department and the attorneys at the Department of Defense and the State Department and the White House, who felt that they could operate only in the dark, only in secrecy. Were both of these sort of unprecedented in American history, or was this focus on the dark aspects of the process intentional?
Well, it certainly was intentional. I mean, I think none of us really knew what Vice President Cheney meant that day. It was the first Sunday after 9/11. He went on Meet the Press and said, we're going to have to work kind of on the dark side. And if we're going to win the war on terror, we need to work in the shadows where these people exist and use any means at our disposal, which in some ways is the most important part of that quote. Any means, this became a prolonged question of whether the ends justified any means to win the war on terror. And he basically was arguing all the way through this period that the threat to America posed by al-Qaeda was so existential and terrifying that we had to do anything and everything, literally leave all our values behind and work in the shadows. And so was it purposeful? Yes. I mean, very much the argument was in the White House that they needed to be forward-leaning and they needed to protect national security, and to do so, they needed to work in secrecy. They couldn't let the enemy know what we were doing, and they also, as a result, couldn't let the American public really know what we were doing. So a secret war was fought. And the president was pretty straightforward about this at various points. He said, I don't know if people will remember, that this is a war where you're not going to know when victory takes place. It's a secret war, basically. And it was very much the determined policy of the White House to keep meetings as small as possible, to keep information as compartmentalized as possible. And what I try to write about is the result of this secrecy is that frequently, and many people who know more about secrecy than I do will tell you, that bad decisions often get made in secret. And without checks and balances, without some kind of daylight coming in where people can see what's going on, people frequently make mistakes, and then they dig into their mistakes. And that's kind of what happened. A lot of decisions were made right after 9/11, and some of them turned out to be fateful and self-destructive, but we kept going because nobody else knew.
Vice President Cheney and his counsel, David Addington, are certainly the two most prominent figures in the book. And it appears, based on your reporting, that Cheney seized control of the whole process very early out, and that President Bush at least acquiesced in it. How did this happen, that the vice president, who normally has such a minor role in the administration of government, how did it happen that this vice president took over?
It is an extraordinary story, and I you know, there's a new book out, excuse me, just to say something nice about a colleague's work. There's a new book out, Angler, by Bart Gellman, which is all about Vice President Cheney and how he did it. I haven't read it yet, but I've read his earlier work, which is fantastic, so it's probably a terrific book. But, you know, Cheney put himself famously on the ticket. He was choosing vice presidents and chose himself. In many ways, and the details of that are, I probably can't use the language that his good friend Stu Spencer used, but he called it the most something Machiavellian thing I've ever seen in my life.
This
is a family show. It is a family show. Okay, I won't quote him completely, but he's a tough pal. And anyway, but Cheney's attributes for the ticket from the start were that he was the wise man on national security. He had been in Washington on and off since Ford's White House. He'd been the Secretary of Defense. He had been quite learned on the subject of the Soviet Union and the Cold War threats, and so this was his area, and so he came in with this portfolio and seized it right away. I mean, pretty much when Dan Quayle met with him right when after Cheney took over the vice president's office, and Quayle came in and said, you know, you're going to be going to a lot of funerals, and Cheney just kind of smiled and said, well, I have a different understanding with the president. And he did have a different understanding. He had a very operational role, and nobody really understood Washington's bureaucracy better than Cheney and Rumsfeld, because they'd been there so long. And Bush was a neophyte by comparison. So this was the area he wanted to be in charge of. It was his portfolio. Terrorism in particular had been added to his portfolio in the run-up to 9/11, and he was just beginning to kind of dig into it when 9/11 hit.
Now, when 9/11 hit, the president was out of town at a speaking engagement, and was the fact that the president was out of town and sort of not on the scene, able to kind of take charge of the levers of government, what role did that play? Or is it your feeling that it was not significant?
I think it's significant, but I actually think it's significant in that it's a snapshot of how things worked, which was behind the scenes, Cheney was in the presidential emergency center calling the shots about whether to shoot down planes or incoming, and laying the legal foundation for the war on terror. And Bush was out front giving speeches, in the political role. That was the division of labor, and what you got to see was that division of labor that day. I mean, it's not just because Bush was reading My Pet Goat that he didn't become the head of the war on terror. It was, you know, he had already been given opportunities to seize this subject. People may remember in August of 2001, he was briefed and told specifically when he was down on vacation. There was the briefing that said that Al-Qaeda is determined to strike America. And his reaction reportedly was to say, okay, you've covered your ass, that's enough. Basically, you've told me, you've passed the buck, fine. And that was the end of his research into the subject. So if he were going to take command, he would have taken command even then. This was not an area that he was really the lead player on at this point.
Can you set the context for really the rest of the story? What was the atmosphere like that Cheney and the president were dealing with, and then can you walk us through kind of the major landmarks of the descent into renditions and torture?
Well, I do think that's very important, what the atmosphere was like inside the White House right after 9/11, because it's not that the Bush administration was, evil or just trying to, there have been many allegations made and all kinds of silly, descriptions of their motives. And in truth, there was a sense of complete panic inside the White House, and there a sense of just horrible responsibility. They all felt that there was going to be another attack. The entire American intelligence community was saying, it's going to happen again, and it's going to happen soon. And there were people in the CIA who were saying to each other, don't go up to New York, it's going to be in New York again. And there was just a sense that if it happened again, they would be blamed. And they already knew, I think, and there's an early chapter in this book where I very carefully tried to explain that in many ways, I think they felt that they were more to blame than the public understood already. They had had a number of warnings, and they hadn't put the dots, connected the dots. And so they felt this awful sense of responsibility. And in fact, they were also, since you're a community of public policy people, something that I think is interesting is they were bombarding themselves with just hair-raising information starting right after 9/11. They changed the kinds of threat information that went to the president and the vice president. It used to be filtered out by the intelligence community, and only the really serious things that were probably reliable were passed on to the top policymakers. After 9/11, Cheney in particular said, I want to see everything. He no longer trusted the filter. So they started getting these things called threat matrix reports, which ran for pages and pages that were every morning, the president and the vice president would sit down and look at every conceivable threat that might come at America from all around the world. And it was described to me by somebody high up in the Justice Department as sort of just crazy making. It was like locking yourself in the room, they said, with Led Zeppelin, which is, you know, a horrible rock band. I mean, you just, you know, your mind would, you would lose perspective, and anybody would. And they really felt that, you know, the end was near, and they were the only thing standing between it and the end of America, basically. And it didn't help that there were false alarms in the White House, too. In particular, they had installed these sensors to try to pick up on any presence of anthrax, particularly after the anthrax attacks started taking place. And anthrax or other weapons of mass destruction or biohazards of various sorts and radiation. And anyway, these new gizmos were highly sensitive. And one went off one day when President Bush was out of town and Cheney was the highest ranking official in Washington. It went off in the Situation Room or near enough so that anybody who'd been in the Situation Room felt that they had been exposed. And Cheney, I am told, thought that he might have been fatally exposed. So this was not just political, it was really personal. They thought that they were, you know, that this was something that was just god-awful and right, you know, in their hands. And it turned out that in that particular case, I gather at least that the alarms were triggered often by perfume. So that was a problem. But you know, Cheney famously traveled to work in the morning. His driver had a duffel bag on the back seat that was filled with a chem suit. And he joked with people when an old friend traveled with him, and he said to the guy, I'm sorry, but I've only got one. And, you know, so, he had kind of a macabre sense of humor about the whole thing. But some people who knew Cheney well, and I talked to an old family friend of his who really goes back years and likes him a lot, and who said that after 9/11, he changed. He seemed really steely, and it was as if he lost his sense of humor, and it was as if he'd seen something awful that he couldn't talk about. So I think the burden that is on these people's shoulders, it tells you something about why they made the policy decisions they did. They thought the situation was really dire, and the path they chose was extreme.
You know? So when did they move from simply concern about the existential threat to ordering the CIA and others to pick up people and do whatever is necessary to extract information from them?
Very fast. I mean, one of the things that interested me in writing this book was how quickly the foundations were laid for this program, this secret program. I mean, really, within about 10 days, the major steps had been taken. The president signed a secret finding that authorized the CIA to send out hit squads around the world to either kill or capture Al-Qaeda members. And it was the capturing, in some ways, that was the unforeseen glitch, because the CIA never had really a history of holding prisoners or of interrogating them much. The CIA, you know, they use polygraphs a lot, and they do polygraph people. But the interrogation of hostile witnesses is really something that the FBI does in this country and the military has done. The CIA didn't have a long history of it, and they didn't have many rules for it. And basically what happened was they put themselves in the position of becoming jailers for the first time. They had no facilities yet, but they had to set up black prison sites, and they had to set up a program of interrogation. And it is there that things got darker and darker. And because basically they set up a program outside of all the rules of law that we recognize in this country. These prisoners were going to be held outside of the criminal law. They were not criminals in the view of the White House. And they were going to be not prisoners of war, so outside of military law and international law. So they kind of found this dark spot with no rules where they could make up the rules as they went along. Now, I mean, and this is not to say that they ad-libbed this. One of the most amazing things to me about this whole history is that everything was bureaucratized and everything was signed off on from the top. And so and by lawyers in particular. The CIA, having gone through many difficult times before in the Church Committee days, did not want to do anything that was not authorized that might result in CIA officers being prosecuted. And so they wouldn't move until the president had signed a finding and the lawyers had said it was legal. And so the first few weeks were preoccupied with getting all the legal memos together that would allow this program to go forward.
Well, there's a lot in the book about the specifics of what was done to the detainees, and some of the material is so graphic that my wife would not let me read the book before going to bed because it disturbed my sleep. But
I guess I should say thank you. I don't know. You know, it's.
But fundamentally, at least the way I read the book, it was between. It's the drama between the lawyers, who are trying to come up with justifications. I think you used the term the golden shield. That would keep these people from being sued or prosecuted for war crimes. And then another group of lawyers who were more interested in the American ideal than and less persuaded of the existential nature of the threat. And the central bad guy in your telling is David Addington, Vice President Cheney's counsel. And unless people have read your long piece in The New Yorker a couple of years ago about Addington, it's probably a name that's unfamiliar. Could you talk a little bit about Addington and his background and how he came to exercise the power that he did?
Yeah, oh sure, he's a wonderful character. I mean, any writer would be attracted to writing about David Addington. He's probably the most powerful person in the country that nobody's ever heard of. And in some ways, he's a prototypical zealot in both the good sense and the bad sense. He's an extremist. But before I get into all the details, I just want to say about this being a fight between lawyers that just to back up one sec, that you're right, the fights do take place, these tremendous clashes that people didn't realize were going on between various groups of lawyers in the administration and outside the administration too. But that happens because there's a vacuum first, and you have to sort of stand back and take a look. And the reason is that at the very top of our government, the president and the vice president basically said, we want our policy to be to go to the farthest outside reaches of the law. We're going to push the limit. And so it left it up to the lawyers to define what those outside limits were. That's why. But I mean, there really is a policy there, which from the top is basically an idea that the limits, the legal limits were weakening America, and they needed to push those limits. And so that was the policy. Then the lawyers come in and try to push the law further. So that's where David Addington comes in. I guess he's about my age, which puts him just over 50, and he is the child of a military family. Was somebody who, during the Vietnam War, felt that we could have won it, but we didn't because the politicians got in the way. And so in that, he shared that view with Cheney, who felt that Congress had pulled us out before we were able to win that war. He had a strong dislike of Congress as a result. And Cheney shared that to some extent. Cheney famously called the other congressmen gnats. And he went, and they, after going to, I guess he went to, where did he go to law school? Duke Law School. He went to work in the CIA General Counsel's office. This is David Addington. Then he worked up on the Hill, where he connected up with Cheney. And the two of them became a great team, because Cheney's not a lawyer, but he has some, you know, he's a brilliant student of government and has very strong views. They shared the same political orientation. Addington is one of those people who has no staff. He has no secretary or anything. He works in a locked office in the White House by himself, but he is so protean. He reads everything. He has a prodigious memory. He is just, you know, he knows all the fine print, and he was famous for having a red pen that he would slash through all legislation and rewrite everything his own way. Anyway, the two of them worked together wonderfully because he could tell Cheney what the laws were, and Cheney could help define the goals with him. And he's not a humorous guy. He's apparently a great person to have on your side. Someone said he's like the Marines, no better friend, no worse enemy. So he and the vice president, right after 9/11, started working together to create the legal memos on which they could wage this secret war to go get al-Qaeda. And Addington's very secretive. He really wanted to limit the number of people who would know anything about these programs to a tiny little clique that he was part of in the White House. There were five men, basically, that called themselves the War Council, and they called the shots. So.
You describe how Vice President Cheney and Addington decided that in many cases the key player was not the public face, but it was the deputy to the public face. And they kind of stacked the bureaucracy with people at the second level who would be largely invisible, who were loyal to them.
Well, they really were good at understanding how Washington works. And you know, I remember when I covered Reagan's White House for the Wall Street Journal, and I remember there was a man named Dick Darman at that time who was very much the same in that he understood that there's sort of two channels of power going up to the president. One is paper flow, and the other is the access of people. And if you can control those spigots, you can control an awful lot of what the president gets to decide. So President Bush famously calls himself the decider. But Addington made it his business that his inbox was the last box before paperwork went to the president. And so he would see everything that went up to the president, and frequently he would just rewrite it. So it would have gone through this whole agency process, and if he didn't think he agreed with it, again, he'd take out the red pen and slash it and redo it. So it was a very smart, savvy tactic.
Pushing back against that group, you talk a little bit about James Comey, and I think most people are familiar with the exchange with the Attorney General when the Attorney General thought that he was extremely sick and was unwilling to yield power back, was unwilling to sign the order extending the wiretapping program, and Comey was involved in that, but also John Bellinger, University of Virginia alum, Alberto Mora, Jack Goldsmith, and others. Could you talk about sort of the drama back and forth between these groups and how that played out?
Well, this is actually part of the reason I wanted to do this book as a book and not just the series of stories I've done in The New Yorker was I felt that along the way, I was talking to people who, again, felt that there was this battle for the soul of the country. And I felt that readers didn't really understand the size of the drama that was going on at this point, because they weren't, like me, able to talk to these people who were pushing back inside the administration. It was not just liberals at the American Civil Liberties Union who were objecting to the sort of detention and interrogation and so-called torture policies. There were people throughout the administration. There were military people who were appalled by what was going on and they felt it was dishonorable, and there were lawyers, and there were also FBI officers who were pushing back. So what I wanted to tell was the story of people who I very much admired, really, who stood up for what they felt was a better way to win the war on terror, which was a way that we could win it without becoming like the enemy. And so I try to detail what they did inside in this book. And they're some wonderful people. They did amazing things. They put their own jobs at risk. And they range from an FBI officer down in Guantanamo who tries to blow the whistle. He's a lawyer, a former prosecutor, and he sort of sends word up through the chain of command that these things that are happening down in Guantanamo are criminal, and people could be prosecuted for what they're doing to some of the prisoners there, and the people on the top have to know about this. And his flag, it's funny, it takes a while, but it works its way finally right up to the very top lawyer in the Navy. He's a civilian lawyer named Alberto Mora. He's a lifelong Republican, a great supporter of the Bush administration. When he gets a report that's worked its way up about this, at first he thinks that it has to be some kind of rogue action, or he thinks, you know, U.S. servicemen wouldn't be doing these things to prisoners, putting underwear on their head and putting leashes on them and making them bark like dogs and keeping them up for days on end and all the other things that were happening that were just kind of, you know, amateur hour, bizarre and cruel. And so he looks into it and he discovers that, in fact, it's a policy and it's been signed off by his own boss, the top lawyer in the Pentagon named Jim Haynes, and even by Rumsfeld himself. And so Mora starts to try to confront his bosses and say, basically, cruelty, whether you call it torture or not, is anathema in America as a state policy. Mora came, his roots were in Cuba. And I think because he had fled as a child a tyrannous government, he was particularly sensitive to the idea of state cruelty as a policy. And so he has these really interesting debates with the people around him, trying to explain why you can't authorize this stuff, and it's a slippery slope. And when you start, he says, you know, basically, when you're saying you can deprive someone of sleep, for how long? There are no limits on these authorities that had been given the soldiers. He's saying, you know, if you lock them up without light, can you do it till they become blind? You know, can you keep them in a pit forever? And there are the rules are really unclear down in Guantanamo, and he's trying to clarify this. So basically, it starts a process at the top of the Pentagon. In the end, he is defeated in his efforts by the Justice Department lawyers who are working closely with David Addington, who basically say the president has a right to authorize anything. To win the war on terror, he can be above the law. There are no limits. He can be, you know, he's not bound, and you can't bind his hands in any way. And so this is where the fight sort of stays back and forth for a while. Other lawyers then start getting read into some of these programs. And it's a little bit like to me, it was a little bit like one of those Hitchcock films in that, you know, you have a kind of a naive good guy who starts looking around and realizes something's going on here, and I'm not sure what it is exactly, but it's bad. And so you get a lawyer like Jack Goldsmith, who's a very conservative lawyer again, who becomes the head of a prominent, small but very powerful office of legal counsel in the Justice Department. And he gets asked a few questions about whether they can do things to prisoners. And he starts wondering, well, what are they doing? And he starts asking for more paperwork. And he's brought then piles of paperwork. And he starts reading through it. And he gets more and more worried about what the United States government's doing. And so he starts working with some other lawyers in the Justice Department, first just to get the information and figure out what's going on. And at some point, they get a huge study from the Inspector General's office of the CIA. And we have, I believe we have a prominent former inspector general in the CIA here today. Yeah. So I feel, you know, an amateur talking about this by comparison. But they get something that's the size of two Manhattan phone books, I'm told. And in it are the details of what's been going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere in the black sites. And it's so different in practice than it looked on a clean piece of paper where it was just a sort of a list of things you can do, you know, that didn't sound so bad. Sleep deprivation. You know, anybody who has a toddler's been through that. It's not the end of the world. But it's in the way that it was carried out, what these lawyers could see suddenly was something horrible. And I'm told by CIA people I've talked to who supported the program, it was so awful also for the people who were part of this program that they never really fully recover from it. It's like, you know, you go to this, if you had nightmares, they have real nightmares. And you know, it's just, it was a terrible thing when you really sort of could get into the details. And so these lawyers then start trying to stop it. And when they do, they come smack into Cheney and his office and David Addington. And it was, I think it's hard to portray how scary it was to go up against David Addington, who was, he's a very tall man, he's way over 6 feet, a very imposing, kind of a bully. And they really felt, the number two Justice Department lawyer, James Comey, and Jack Goldsmith, were so worried about what they were doing in trying to push back on this that they developed a code where they'd have a code word for torture, because they thought that they were either being, you know, somehow wiretapped or surveilled, or they might even be, they felt kind of like in physical danger. And they just could see how much the government was invested in this and how difficult it was going to be to pull it back, because to fix these policies in a way meant admitting that what had happened before was wrong and maybe criminal. And so people were really invested. Anybody who'd been involved in it was very protective of it. And so anyway, so there are these Leviathan, these tremendous fights take place, so.
You speak with real respect of Senator McCain.
I do, yeah. I think that, first of all, I think in a quick sentence, he captured to me what the essence of what was so important about this fight, which is, it's not about them, it's about us. And he understood that it's not because we want to coddle terrorists, it's about what kind of people we are and what kind of country we are. And he understood it, of course, in a way very few people could, because he'd been a prisoner of war for 5 years and in Vietnam and been through terrible treatment. And he had broken. I mean, he had given up a lot of information, and he understood that people do. But he also understood they give up terrible information. They make stuff up. It's unreliable. And he said over and over again, torture doesn't work. It just is going to give you all kinds of bad information. And it's whatever you get is not worth it. And he understood, of course, he has great respect for the military. He understood that it debased the military. So he took on a fight. The Democrats tried very hard in Congress to take this on, but they really couldn't get very far. They were ridiculed as being, you know, pro-terrorist. Dick Durbin, in particular, senator from Illinois, had tried this to push back on what happened down and fix what was going on in Guantanamo, and he'd really been just scorched for it politically. And so McCain had the stature to take this on in a way that very few did, because he is conservative, is obviously pro-military, and had been through these experiences. So he actually went toe-to-toe with Cheney on this. And the details of those meetings have not come out yet. I would really love to know what those conversations were like. But he, of course, because of McCain's leadership, Congress passed 99-0, it was, the Detainee Treatment Act, which basically said the U.S. has to treat anybody in its custody humanely.
I want to ask you one final question, and then we'll invite questions from the those who are here in the room. So those of you who are contemplating asking questions, please join Christina Lopez-Gattardi there in the back. But the last question I'd like to ask has to do with the use of torture in trials or other proceedings. Not only is the information perhaps unreliable, but is it admissible? What happens when it's introduced in trials? What have the judges done with it?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I've interviewed a lot of them, but I can play one here. I wouldn't want to do that. But at any rate, I quote someone in the book, Bruce Rydell, who was a longtime CIA officer, saying, there's not a court, a legitimate court in America that could try these detainees now, because the cases have been so contaminated by the mistreatment of them that they would be able to get it thrown out. But of course, we don't have a regular court that's likely to hear these right now. They're going in front of sort of specially designed military commissions down in Guantanamo. Already, they have had to throw out some charges. In the Hamden case, some of the evidence had to be thrown out because it was coerced out of him in Afghanistan. So it's possible. I mean, I think that the tragedy of this whole thing is by panicking and setting up a extra legal and maybe illegal system, we will wind up finding it harder to really put away some of the worst terrorists on the face of the earth. People like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, it may be very hard to convict him. They're having to go to great lengths to try to get information that's not contaminated by his treatment now. I mean, and the irony is he's a tremendous egotist and boaster, and he'd already given a confession on camera to Al Jazeera where he said, I did it all, I designed 9/11, and there could not be an easier case to try ordinarily, but because of what they've put him through, waterboarding and everything else, it's going to be difficult, and it's also going to give him the PR advantage in some ways, which I think is really a killer to contemplate, that he could have designed the attacks of 9/11 and now turn himself into a victim, but because of the way the United States treated him.
Christina?
I'd like to ask a specific question. I think it'd be more general questions, but I'd like to ask, since you talked about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, under torture, he gave up the name of an acquaintance. I've forgotten her name for a moment. She's a neuroscientist trained at MIT, maybe Mosul or something, and she has two sons.
Oh, Siddiqui is her name?
That's the lady. And I'm a retired scientist, so I find it a little hard to believe that this neuroscientist laboratory person would be a terrorist, but it's possible. People can believe in things. So could you make a comment on and of course, we have now shot her in the abdomen, and there's some talk that even though she supposedly was captured a few weeks ago, that she's actually been a prisoner for 5 years in Pakistan. So could you comment on whether or not you think she's a prisoner, and whether you think her shooting was justified, and do you have any opinions on whether or not she's a terrorist? Because I think that people will say anything under torture.
Well, one of the things that I tried to do in this book is stick to what I know, and really be careful and try to be accurate. And there have been, unlike some other books that have come out, nobody has said that this book is inaccurate. The CIA has not denounced it, nor the White House or anything else. So that is all to lead me to say, I don't know the ins and outs of her case. And if I did, I would give you an opinion, but I just don't know the story there. It's a really weird story. There are very few female prisoners, but there were reports in Bagram Air Force Base. There were reports in the prison there that there were female voices screaming. I just don't know how accurate they were, and I just don't know her story. I mean, and one of the strange things about America's embrace of these kind of strange extra legal means of justice is that, we find ourselves like Pakistan, where people disappear and you don't know what happened to them and you don't know what the facts are, and it's hard to judge the allegations against them. It's just such an alien experience for a country where the rule of law is so reliable. So I don't really know what her situation is.
Jane, I just want to say, I think you've written an extraordinary book here.
Thank you.
I'm using it both of my classes, and I think that what I want to ask you is, what's the end game? We talked about it a minute before this session. Will we go through a period where, as opinion changes by virtue of this superb work you've done and other reporters, that we really insist on some accountability here. How do we get back to the rule of law? And secondly, I think it's fair to point out, and you made a very good point about it, that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we really were confused. We just didn't know how extensive the Al-Qaeda threat was. And won't we have to reconvene a Geneva Convention or some sort of group of international lawyers to deal with this phenomenon of enemy combatants, people who are out there willing to toss a bomb into a mosque, kill innocent civilians? They don't come under any real category now. You say the administration refused to treat them as criminals. They really weren't prisoners of war under any of the treaties. They certainly, under Common Article 3, couldn't be subjected to cruel and inhuman treatment. But they also probably can't be turned back into the body politic to go out and do this again.
It's a problem. And whoever gets this White House is going to have just an immediate set of you know, all kinds of problems to solve here. In particular, there are now a number of legal claims and charges filed against people in the Bush administration. One of the things that happened in this war on terror, this new paradigm, was a couple innocent people were picked up and renditioned by the CIA by mistake and put in dungeons and eventually released and acknowledged to have been mistakes. But these were people who were really put through the mill while they were in U.S. custody, and they are suing the United States. And one of the questions so far, the Bush administration has argued these cases can't really be heard because just to hear them in an open court would violate national security. But one of the plaintiffs is somebody named Maher Arar, who's a Canadian engineer who there was a 3-year investigation of what happened to him in Canada. Canada was able to investigate this, you know, adequately without violating its own national security, and result was they awarded him $10 million. Maher Arar is still on the United States watch list for reasons that nobody can explain. And even though when he was held in Syria, even the Syrians said he's not a terrorist. So he's suing America. The next president's going to have to figure out, are they going to keep arguing that nobody can hear these cases, or are they going to let these cases move forward? There are a lot of cases. There are obviously a lot of prisoners down in Guantanamo. There's some prisoners down there who, according to the Red Cross report, which I wrote about, the Red Cross said were tortured, which is a war crime. There are potential war crimes problems for the people in the Bush administration. I mean, there is a lot to deal with here. There are also all kinds of memos, legal memos that are classified that some people think have been overclassified simply to cover up embarrassment, including the list of all of the sort of techniques that were authorized by the White House to use on these prisoners. The question will be for the next White House, are they going to let the public know what really happened during this period? And if we do learn the full history, what do we do about it? Do we prosecute people who, for the most part, were trying to protect the country and doing it for what they thought were patriotic reasons, or do we let them off? Is it a good enough excuse that they thought they were doing it for good reasons? Or do we sweep it under the rug? And if so, you know, what example does that set for people in the future? Because I know I've interviewed people at the CIA who've said to me they refuse to get involved in this interrogation program because they'd seen in the past that there had been criminal prosecutions that had happened at the CIA when people crossed a line, and they didn't want to go there. So if there are no criminal prosecutions this time, what message does that send? I think it's an incredibly complicated set of problems I imagine that Obama and McCain have different approaches to it. Already McCain has kind of cut a deal with the CIA where he has allowed them to use techniques that are unspecified, but interrogation techniques that are stronger and different from what the military is allowed to use. Nobody knows exactly what, but he's kind of cut them some slack. And people were surprised about that. People thought that maybe he did this to for political reasons, in order to seem like he was more on the same song sheet as the Bush administration, as the campaign unrolled. Obama's a constitutional law professor. He certainly understands what the issues are here. The two of them disagreed on whether or not prisoners in the war on terror should have habeas corpus rights. Obama has said they should. McCain has said they shouldn't. So there are strong issues between them. I whoever gets it, the one thing you know is it's going to be a nightmare to deal with.
We have the Geneva Conventions that regulate how to do warfare among nation states. They apparently are totally useless against terrorists because A, they simply don't abide by them, and B, they use it against the civilized world. Now, in the, we have criminal justice system to handle criminals. And of course, criminals know that they get punished if they do something wrong. And so the justice system is there to deter as well as to punish those who go against the laws. I believe it's also useless against terrorists because they simply avoid it. And how do you punish somebody who is actively seeking death in his cause? So my question is really, is there any thinking going on anywhere in the world, internationally, on how to handle terrorists? Because neither of these two proposed methods seem to work.
Well, I mean, most of the rest of the world defines terrorists, as we did before 9/11, as criminals, not as warriors. And in fact, our allies in Europe think that we are flattering them by calling them warriors, because it's not a war. They're mass murderers and psycho and sociopaths, and so that is how the rest of the world deals with them. And we actually did a very good job of dealing with them that way before 9/11, I think. And that story is not so well known, but the Al Qaeda cell that bombed the World Trade Center the first time was put through a terrific trial. We learned an awful lot about Al-Qaeda from it. They were all convicted on serious terrorism charges, and they're all serving life sentences in places like Florence, Colorado, and we also got informants out of it. So, I think the criminal paradigm works up to a point. The problem is after that point, right now Congress has authorized the use of military force and defines Al-Qaeda as like a war enemy, so that you can kill them on sight, which is something that you couldn't do if they were just criminals. I mean, and so, for instance, if we find bin Laden, I think there are very few people who think we should cuff him and take him back and put him on trial. I think that people are more likely to think you could just shoot him. And Congress has authorized that. I think it's some amalgam of the two. But really, those are limited conversations. They're interesting and important, but the smart people I know have moved on to the conversation about how do you win the battle for the hearts and minds of the next generation of young Muslims. It's got to be something bigger than just plain catching the people who are actively involved in this, because every time you catch some, more can be converted into doing the same thing. You really have to figure out how to fight an ideological war here, I think. And that's what a lot of people are saying that I've been interviewing. So,
When you were researching the book, I'd be interested to know what sort of access you had to records and what weren't you able to get hold of that would have been useful to you. And now, since the vice president has declared that he's a member of no department of the government and has had a judicial ruling against that idea, what is going to happen to those records? Do you think they're warming up the shredding machines?
They're probably whirring away already. I would have loved to have gotten more records. I come out of my own background is as a failed history graduate student, so I come at this as a somebody who loves history, and I think the records are tremendously valuable. You know, among the things I would really like to see personally, and I imagine we never will, but it would be really useful to see the transcripts of these interrogations, because, you know, this fight has raged back and forth, this torture work. Well, it would be nice to see whether people gave up really good information or bad when they were being tortured. An awful lot of people say we've gotten unreliable information that's led us in terrible directions, including helping getting us into the war in Iraq because one of the detainees made up information about there being weapons of mass destruction, which they believed at the time and then discovered later was a lie. But I'd like to see those interrogation logs, and I'd like to see if you need to waterboard people to get them to say things, and if you do, what you get them to say. The White House has argued that it was necessary and incredibly valuable. An awful lot of people doubt that, and I think it would be great to know. So,
just two observations, if I may, as a former Department of Justice official who's worked in this area. I think one of the critical features following 9/11 is the fact that the paradigm did shift to one of prevention rather than after the fact addressing it in a criminal modality, as we did during the first Trade Center attack. The premise was that we cannot afford to permit, regardless of the quality of the evidence we develop in terms of admissibility, we cannot afford to allow the incident to occur and then address it in terms of traditional punishment and criminal justice remedies. So I think that plays into the whole question of then what are the limits, because the courts have generally imposed those limits on how far you can go in terms of procedure in the criminal justice system. But the more important question I think I would like to pose or observation is, it seems during this whole period, and I agree with your observations about the potential consequences, that nowhere was the National Security Council functioning as traditionally it did. And likewise, the State Department, that was also part of the process, did not weigh in seemingly, at least as forcefully as they could have, with given the standing of the officials both at the NSC and the State Department during this period of time. If it was a matter of principle, and if they did have access, notwithstanding Cheney and Abington, they could go to the president directly and just say, "You have a cancer in your house."
So they did at certain points, but one of the things that happened was that the top lawyer at the State Department, Will Taft, and the top lawyer at the National Security Council, John Bellinger III, they were both left out of the loop. So they did not even know what was happening inside this tiny clique of lawyers. David Addington and a handful of others were rewriting the laws and reinterpreting the limits of American power without cueing in the experts in the areas of the State Department, national security law at the National Security Council, And they also left out the TJAGs on purpose, the military lawyers, because they didn't like what their points of view were. And so it was kind of a coup of a tiny little group of extremists that took over. Now, afterwards, there were executive orders already signed, for instance, for the Military Commissions Act, Powell and Condi Rice learned about this, and they basically said, "What just happened?" They learned about it by watching CNN. And so they were, you know, at that point, they could have made more of a stink. And Powell, that many people have said over time, there are many things he could have resigned over time. But they really were not in power in these particular councils and on these particular decisions. The only other thing I wanted to say about the change in the criminal paradigm to a preventive mode, which is, you're right, that is very much what they were trying to do, was to disrupt terrorist acts before they happened, which of course creates all kinds of problems for a country where you need evidence and you can't be just found guilty of thought crimes. But having interviewed a lot of people at the FBI they really take umbrage at that description, I have to say, because they say, what do people think? We're just sitting around and waiting for people to blow things up before we stop them? You know, they it's not as if the criminal paradigm in this country before 9/11 was to wait for terrorist acts to take place. They were already trying to get wiretaps on phones and prevent all sorts of criminal acts from taking place. So, and we do have conspiracy laws and RICO statutes and things like that. I mean, they may need to strengthen them, but I'm not really sure that it was the lack of tools that stopped us from stopping 9/11. I have to say, I'm not sure. I think our legal system is very strong, and we have, I have great respect for it. And I think the reason that they didn't see 9/11 coming isn't because our criminal laws were not good enough. It's because, really, there were a couple people who dropped the ball. Inside the CIA, they forgot to tell the FBI that two of the people who were future hijackers had come inside America. The CIA had information that these two Al-Qaeda suspects had come and were on their way to California a year before 9/11, and they didn't notify the FBI of this, and the FBI didn't realize. And then the FBI had mistakes of its own, but when you go back and look at this, it's incredibly painful. Garden variety human incompetence is kind of what helped get us to 9/11, and I'm not sure we needed to throw the whole legal code out for it.
A number of people have been waiting patiently to ask questions, but I regret to say we have time for just one more.
Well, then first I want to thank you so much for presenting such a complex subject in such a clear and comprehensive way. You brought the subtlety of so many sides of this, and in this forum it's amazing how much we've learned. My interest is, where was Congress in this? You mentioned how Addington and Cheney had no use for Congress. You mentioned McCain's role in trying to drum up support for the torture issue. But talking about checks and balances, where was Congress in all of this? My thinking is, some of the lawyers who felt threatened but were very adamant about what was going on and felt enraged, couldn't they have used Congress in some way, or even the press more quickly? Where was Congress? They were in the dark too.
Well, they weren't completely in the dark. There were usually at least four, if not eight, members of Congress who were being read into these programs because of their oversight role. But they were tightly, they had to stay tight-lipped because it was considered national security secrets that they were told. So in some ways, you might remember that Senator Rockefeller had a note in his desk, a copy of a letter he sent to Cheney saying that he opposed these programs, but he couldn't go public with it because he was afraid he would be violating national security, and we didn't learn about all of this till later. I think, Congress was supine, basically. They were not, Congress saw this as a political loser of an issue to take on the way the White House was fighting the war on terror. It was going to look like coddling terrorists. And to some extent, they're still there. I mean, this is not a subject that you see a lot of profiles and courage in Congress on.
So. This is an extraordinary book, and Jane Mayer will be signing copies of the book after this presentation. Jane, we thank you for writing the book and for being here.
Glad to be here. Thanks a lot.